Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicles Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Moira O'Neill and joining me on the show today are my colleagues Leonora Walters and Chris Dillow. And we're also delighted to welcome a special guest, Julian Chester, partner and private client broker at Killick & Co. Today we're going to be talking about starting out in investing, alternatives to traditional bond funds, and the launch of Woodford Patent Capital. Now, this week's Portfolio Clinic in Investors Chronicle magazine features a 23-year-old, and he's been investing for 6 months. He's put together a portfolio of 7 stocks, and these are mainly larger FTSE 100 companies such as BP, Royal Dutch Shell and GlaxoSmithKline. And his aim is to secure a secondary income through investing. And we thought it was great that he showed a passion for investing and he was very keen, he was starting out, but also that young investors can be overconfident about their abilities. And one of the most interesting things about what this investor said was that after just 6 months in the market, he thinks he has a talent for equity research. Now, Chris, can this be possible? Can he have a talent already? What do you think?
It's theoretically possible, but I very much doubt it. Let me put it this way. There are very, very few people who have the ability to outperform the market over the long run on average. But there are very, very many people who are overconfident about their abilities. So I would suspect that what we have here is a case of overconfidence rather than genuine ability. And I wouldn't even try to assess whether someone has genuine ability unless I've got about 10 years. Of track record.
So he's jumping the gun a bit after 6 months, although, you know, it's great that he's interested. We need some more data there to prove the case.
Yes, yeah. I would stress that starting early is one of the best things you can possibly do, simply because of the power of compounding. You know, if you can get a 5% return a year for 25 years, you're going to end up a lot richer than if you invest only for 20 years. You know, so in that sense, he's got the big thing right. What worries me is that he might be overconfident.
Julian, do you see younger investors feeling like they can really shoot the lights out with their equity portfolios and be overconfident?
Yes, I suppose we do. And, you know, 6 months is a very, very short period of time. And actually, since the sell-off in October, we've had strong equity markets. So it's been a very positive period to be investing in, which doesn't really test out his ability to deal with the bear market.
Uh-huh. So you don't know what's around the corner, really. How would you go about advising this young person in terms of his overall portfolio, because he's only got 7 stocks so far? Where does he need to go from here?
Yes, I mean, obviously stock selection and investment selection is important, but actually probably the most important thing is diversification. And at this point, obviously, he's very condensed in, you know, very concentrated in just a few stocks, and particularly he's focused on oils, the oil sector and the basic materials. So it would be, from our point of view, if you were starting afresh, we would look to have full diversification from the beginning. Because it is very difficult to predict what is around the corner. And if you're just backing the oil sector and the basic mineral sector, you know, as we've seen with a very weak oil price and also falling commodity prices, you know, that bears a lot of pain.
So what other sectors should a beginner investor be looking at?
Well, we look at 10 sectors. So in this portfolio that he's got about 5 of those, but heavily skewed to commodities and to oil. I mean, if you look at sectors such as consumer goods, consumer services, telecoms, technology, I mean, these are all very important sectors, and at the moment he's got no exposure to those at all. The other point to note is on diversification, it's not just about sectors, it's also about geography and asset allocation. So at the moment, it is all equity, and it's all mainly UK equity. So there's no exposure to the US, to Europe, to Asia, to other parts of the world.
And how would you best go about getting exposure to overseas equities and other assets?
I mean, my advice to him would be to look at collective investment schemes, so ETFs, unit trusts, investment trusts. I mean, these are the best vehicles to get diversification and get exposure. So if we were looking to have exposure to Europe, we would select one of a number of European funds where we know the manager, we know what's how they're investing, which sectors they're exposed to and their style.
Chris, I know you also probably would advise funds, but you may not look at the active funds. What would you think?
Yeah, the easiest way to diversify is simply to get yourself a tracker fund. Now, for a younger person, these have an especial advantage in that they have low fees. And the thing about the power of compounding is that it can work against you. An additional fee of 1% per year on an active fund compounds quite horribly over 20 or 30 years. So you have to be very, very confident about fund manager ability to want to incur that extra cost. And I would advise that the cheapest and easiest thing to do is to go for a low-cost tracker or ETF fund.
Julian, I can see you shaking your head there. What's your view?
I think in the post-RDR world, for when we invest for investors in collectives, we're looking at the institutional units. So actually, the cost of investing with decent fund managers has really dropped. So, say for an average equity fund, you may be paying 0.75%, which is actually very reasonable.
It's still more than a tracker, though, isn't it?
It is, but yes. The problem I have with a tracker is you get everything. It's not at all selective. So there may be sectors in a tracker that you don't want exposure to, or maybe they'll have downturns for multiple years. So why sort of be sitting on underperforming sectors? Obviously, with a fund manager, they can be far more selective. They're using analytical tools, they're using qualitative tools, and it's a more selective approach.
Chris, we did talk a bit about in the portfolio review about beating the professionals, because this young chap obviously thinks he can and he has ability. And I think you had a few comments about how that might be stacked against him. Can you explain that?
Yeah, and just think about the advantages that the professional fund manager has. You know, he has lower dealing costs, he's got a massive team of analysts behind him, he's got access to brokers' research, to company management. Now, all of that gives the professional a massive advantage over the ordinary retail stock picker. And you're probably not going to beat the professionals if you try to know more about large companies. So what you've got to try and do, if you want to try and beat the market, is to think about what fund managers' weak points are and to focus upon those.
And so does that lead you to smaller companies, really, do you think?
Well, not necessarily. It is the case that some smaller stocks are under-researched, but in the largest universe of those under-researched companies, or AIM, we know that AIM tends to underperform quite badly over the longer run. What I'd do instead is consider what the fund manager's weak points are. For example, a lot of active fund managers worry about benchmark risk, the risk of underperforming their peers. And that can lead them to avoid defensive stocks, which means that defensive stocks can be underpriced. You know, the professional fund manager has to diversify because he can't concentrate in half a dozen stocks. And that means that he's often buying stocks not because he thinks they're good investments, but simply because he's got to spread risk. Whereas the retail investor can focus on a few good ideas and obtain diversification through funds.
Which leads us back to him using funds. Now, Julian, are there some areas in which it's better to use an active manager and others in which you would go for trackers? What do you think there?
Yes, I mean, there are certain geographical regions and certain industrial sectors that are better to use a specialist. And I suppose for me, looking at something like pharmaceuticals and healthcare, it's a very complicated area. The companies are mainly in the US, but with some in Europe as well and elsewhere in the world. But it's complicated. It's a specialised industry. And for me, a specialist in that area is far better to outperform, and they can see where the value is, where the opportunities are.
Okay. And you would advise mixing direct stocks alongside funds in a portfolio. That's a reasonable way to go about constructing a portfolio.
Yes, I mean, for the clients I look after, I would use a hybrid model where I'm looking at collectives and equities side by side. So there are certain areas, maybe geographical areas, that I'd use a fund, or sector areas where I'd use a fund. But there are other areas where we would go for direct stocks.
What do we think about the size of this young investor's holdings? He had just shy of £3,000 in the portfolio. He'd already got seven holdings, so he'd got less than, well, he'd got about £400 in each. Is that the right way to go about building up a portfolio, these small amounts, Julian?
I would say no. I would be looking at a collective from the outset, just because I think there is too much idiosyncratic risk with individual stocks when you've only got seven stocks and heavily concentrated on a couple of sectors. So for me, the starting point would be to, you know, start with a collective, and then maybe in the future, once you've built a core of collectives, to then look at direct stocks as a secondary phase.
Chris, does that sound sensible to you? Do you think you should go for the tracker first? In your
Yes. Very definitely.
Yeah, but you would start with the tracker fund as the core holding.
I probably would, yes, because to know what the best active funds are, you know, you need to do your own research, you need to gather your own expertise, just like with stock picking. Mm-hmm. Whereas the tracker fund is the easiest option for a beginner.
Julian, do you have any final thoughts on advice for beginner investors? Is there anything that's crucial to think about?
I think for me, apart from diversification, which we've covered, it's selection. And I suppose as a house, we go into great detail to select from thousands of funds. And that is analytical, it's qualitative, and it's also involves meeting the fund manager and having attending presentations where we can actually understand and ask questions of the fund managers that we're investing with. So I suppose advice is important. If you're going it alone, then probably a tracker is the best. But if you want something a bit more sophisticated with more selection process, then, you know, an advisory house is a better choice.
Yeah, but this guy wants to do it by himself. He wants to do all the research himself, and he wants to start out, which is fair enough. There's plenty of people doing that themselves. Chris, what's your final thoughts on beginners and what they should be thinking about?
What I'd advise is, remember that most of the money that you're going to make or lose will be made in the future. And what you've got an advantage in as a youngster is the fact that you can learn from other people's mistakes. So I would advise him to read a lot about behavioural finance, about cognitive biases. And so in that way, he will at least know what mistakes we commonly make, and he'll be alert to avoiding them.
Where can you read more about behavioural finance? Have you got any recommendations?
Well, there's one very readable book by James Montier called The Little Book of Behavioural Investing. Hmm. I'd also recommend books by Daniel Kahneman and Dan Ariely on cognitive biases generally, because they'll teach you the mistakes you make in everyday life as well as in investing.
Oh, they sound very interesting. Well, thanks very much. That's great. Now, we have been talking about diversification, but when you're thinking about this, you need to spread your portfolio between the major asset classes, and that's usually at least between equities and bonds. And one way to get exposure to bonds is via an actively managed bond fund. But there's been plenty of concerns over corporate bonds. Poor rates of return on government bonds have led many advisors to recommend strategic bond funds. And these are managed by professionals who've got the flexibility to move between different fixed income assets. However, they're not the only option for the income portion of your portfolio. And this week, Leonora has been looking at listed debt funds, which some advisors say can be used as alternatives to bond funds. Now, Leonora, what are listed debt funds? Can you help us out?
Yeah, they're basically investment trusts which invest in a variety of debt instruments that perhaps you wouldn't ordinarily find in your regular corporate bond fund. And these can include asset-backed securities, loans and real estate debt. Now, the advantage of these is they can offer more attractive yields and returns than corporate and certainly government bonds at the moment. And I suppose the advantage investment trusts have is they don't have to meet investor redemptions because they've got fixed capital. So even if there's a liquidity problem, you know, ability to buy and sell the underlying assets, they don't have to meet investor redemptions and sell on assets. So they're quite well placed to buy things that you know, are not easy to sell. I think that the reason why people are kind of flagging them is in particular the attractive yields. If you look at the sector, quite a few of the investment trusts have a yield of 4% or more, and even better, quite a lot of them have floating rate assets. So if interest rates go up, the returns go up with them. So that provides a bit of protection, and that might start, interest rates might rise later this year, so that's fairly useful. There's always a but though. These funds are actually really quite risky, probably in theory much riskier than a corporate bond fund, and far and away riskier than say UK government debt. Quite a lot of risks. I'm not going to go into them all. If you look at the magazine, we've got them set out. But just to summarise, I suppose, well, the main and obvious one is default, and that applies to any debt fund. If the underlying security is default, you might get lower returns. I think as well, because they're investing in debt, if the value of the debt falls, then it could affect the trust returns, I guess a bit like equity. Now, the investment trust structure is great, they don't have to meet redemptions, but if the underlying assets are liquid and hard to buy and sell, the investment trust is likely to swing out to a wide discount to net asset value. And we've seen that in the past on investment trusts and illiquid securities like property. We've gone into double digit discounts to NAV, so that is something you have to consider. Another issue with listed debt funds is that they're relatively new. Most of them launched in the last 2 years. There are a few old stalwarts in there, one of which you include in our IC Top 100 funds. That's Henderson Diversified Income. But most of them, 6 months old, 12 months old. So you can't really assess the track record or the managers and, have a look at how they done, and that's quite important of a fund.
Why are they being recommended then?
They're not being wholesale recommended. I think people are looking at it as an alternative because, there are such problems in the debt markets and with corporate bond funds and, illiquidity. So it's just an alternative area. They've got floating rate assets that could come up with interest rates. They do offer far more attractive yields. Basically, higher risk, higher return.
Julian, have you looked at this sector at all, listed debt funds? What's your view?
Yes, this is an important area. For the bond exposure that our clients have, we look at low duration at the moment just because of the interest rate risk. We don't want to expose the client's capital to falls as rates rise and normalise.
Do you get that through actively managed bond funds, or would you look to an exchange traded fund way?
I'm not against exchange traded funds, and we do use them. So for ETFs that follow sort of short dated bond indices, then that's, we're looking at those. I suppose the non-standard bond funds as well, we're looking at funds that invest in mortgage securities, which is similar to what has been discussed just then.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any particular favourite funds to give exposure?
I suppose, we invest with 24 Asset Management, who have the Monument Bond Fund, and that is made up of UK, European and Australian mortgage-backed securities. So that's all very short dated. I think the duration is sort of 0.25, so it means you're at the very short end of the yield curve. So if interest rates do go up, you'll benefit from the prevailing rate as it changes rather than being locked in. I suppose a lot of your classic bond funds have durations of 7 or 8 years, which, when rates do normalise, that is going to be very painful.
Now, when you described that fund, you said mortgage-backed securities. For some investors, they might think, oh, that sounds terribly worrying. It sounds a bit dangerous. Is it?
I suppose mortgage-backed securities got a bad name because of the, subprime issues in the US. Actually, the way that mortgages work in the UK and Europe and Australia are totally different, and there's a lot more scrutiny over before the lending happens. So the borrower is scrutinised in terms of income and their ability to repay the debt. So actually, it's less. It does raise eyebrows, but it's not as bad as it sounds. And actually, there's very low volatility in these types of funds because it is all very short dated with very good covenants and protection for investors.
Okay, thanks, Julian. Now, one of the other biggest investment stories this month has been the initial public offering of Neil Woodford's latest venture, and it's called the Woodford Patient Capital Trust. And this actually started trading this week, started trading on Tuesday. Leonora, you were looking at its performance so far. What's been happening?
Well, it's done incredibly well. Last week, we reported it increased its maximum issuance size to 800 million, and it took in 800 million, which even beats Anthony Bolton's fundraising in 2010 and makes it the largest ever UK domiciled investment company raising. It was actually oversubscribed as well. They could have had more if they wanted. It's oversubscribed by nearly 10%. And it's still popular. It's trading at a premium to NAV. It initially went up over 2%. And when I looked yesterday, it was on a 3.5% premium to net asset value. Now, I think it was quite a lot of money. And one reader actually asked a really good question. He said, if it raised all that money, will the trust have to have extra investments of less quality? Or, will the underlying companies perhaps make Neil Woodford pay more for them? And I think the answer to that is a firm no. Woodford Asset Management were fairly geared up for this. They said that when they decided to increase the issue, they considered very carefully how much they could have and still meet the original investment strategy and deploy capital in a 1 to 2 year period, and decided they could do it with 800 million. And I think that's bearing out. Neil Woodford said on Monday, I think it was, that he's got 30 investment ideas ready to go, and he's going to execute on them quite fast. And one has already been revealed. They have subscribed to a share placing in AIM-listed Sphere Medical Holding. This is a company that provides monitoring and diagnostic devices for critical care. It's very much in keeping with the theme of the investment trust, which is going to be medical-focused.
Mm-hmm. So it's medical-focused and it's early-stage companies.
Alternative investment market-listed, yes.
Julian, you've been obviously been watching this launch of the Woodford Patient Capital Trust. What's your view of it?
I think this area of investing is obviously short of supply of capital. I mean, intellectual property in the UK there's plenty of it, but in terms of commercialising that intellectual property and bringing it to market has been quite challenging, I think, in the UK because of the lack of long-term capital commitment. I think the figures showing the US are far better at doing this than we are. So this is a great opportunity for investors, and I think it offers genuine long-term capital growth. And by that, I mean sort of more than a 10-year horizon. And as Neil said at the presentation I attended, he's looking at indefinite investments, not just 10 or 20 years, but indefinite. So if it's a good idea, he will increase the commitment over time and look to stay with that investment.
Do you think investors who haven't got in already have missed the boat? With the premium, I think it's 3.5%.
No, I mean, we obviously supported it for our clients and we got a good allocation of the new stock, but I don't think investors have missed it at all. I mean, the remit for the fund or for the trust is to generate at least 10% of capital return per year. And I think the performance fee kicks in beyond that for Woodford. So if you think about that and you think about compounding, I know Chris talked about compounding earlier. If you compound 10% over several decades, I mean, it's a massive return. So I don't believe investors have missed the opportunity. I think this is just the very, very, very early stages.
Okay, so that's definitely one to watch then. Well, you can read more about tips for beginner investors, listed debt funds and the Woodford launch in this week's issue of Investors Chronicle. Thank you to my special guest, Julian Chester of Killick & Co, and to Leonora Walters and Chris Dillo of the Investors Chronicle. And thank you all for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.